Hi everyone. Today we enter the Iron Age, the last period of British prehistory. There are four episodes left of this series, one of which will be an end of the series special. There we'll talk about what we've learnt and try and bring this long and complicated narrative to some sort of satisfying conclusion. But I won't be going away once the series ends. No. Instead, whilst I'm reading and writing about the Romano, British, Anglo-Saxons, Picts and Vikings, I'll be releasing a set of monthly specials, interviews, reviews, who knows. So, if you have any questions for the end of the series special, or any requests for special episodes, please, let me know. Just because I'm the one doing the talking doesn't mean I'm the only person involved in building this podcast. This is your time to direct the course of the podcast by choosing what I talk about for the next few months. If you want to help the podcast in other ways, you know what to do. Tell your friends or leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Otherwise, if you want more old bones in your life, Patreon's the place. A few more patrons and I'll start releasing bonus content, depending on whatever the community wants. That's enough guff from me, though. Let's get on with the show. Our story today starts 2,600 years ago, 600 years after our last episode. A lot has happened in that time. Well, a lot has happened in that time, we think. You see, the period we call the Late Bronze Age is often also called the Dark Age. Across all of Europe, settlement sites became smaller and harder to see. Burials practically disappear, and if it wasn't for the occasional sword or axe head, it would seem like humans disappeared entirely. It's for another episode to talk about what we think was happening during that time. Maybe it's one for the patrons or one of those in-between specials. Today, though, we're going to talk about the early and middle Iron Ages in Britain. We'll go from around 2,600 years to 2,200 years ago. This is a period when a lot of incredible things are happening on the continent. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle are walking about during this time period, helping us truly understand what it means to be human. Aristotle will end up teaching Alexander, who will conquer half the known world before he turns 31, and be forever known afterwards as Alexander the Great. The world which he conquers is an old one. At the start of our discussion today, it will be ruled by arguably the most vicious empire of all time, the Neo-Assyrian Empire. By the time Alexander rides in halfway through today's time period, the Assyrians will have been seen off by the Persians, the empire of Darius and Xerxes. The men stopped by the Greeks first at Marathon, and then at the Pass of Thermopylae, on the waves at Salamis, and finally, permanently, on the fields of Plataea. Whilst all that is happening, in Western Europe, around Switzerland, a new culture is arising. One defined by chariots, swirling metalwork, glorious moustaches, and great warriors. We call them the Celts. This early and middle Iron Age is a time of heroes and geniuses, empires falling and civilizations rising. And halfway down the Italian peninsula, the small city-state of Rome is beginning to flex its muscles. This season is about Britain, though, not Europe. We're still learning a lot about this period of British history. The Celtic culture of Britain isn't the result of invasions or changes coming from France and Switzerland. Instead, the people we're talking about are the descendants of those who lived near Stonehenge 2,000 years earlier. They chose which parts of the new Celtic culture they wanted to adopt. But they were forever British and have ever since been surrounded by a fog of mystery which was still inching our way through towards any sort of certain understanding. So today, we'll do our best to talk about Celtic society. What was their religion like? How did they do politics? What was their economic setup? And just how violent were these people really? At the centre of our discussion will be Danebury Hill Fort. This vast site was dug by Sir Barry Cunliffe during the 70s and 80s and is one of the greatest examples of British field archaeology. 47% of a site the size of 8 football pitches was excavated. The real football, mind, the one you play with your feet, not whatever it is they play in the USA. And then amongst the roundhouses and vast fortifications are found the remains of at least 90 people and maybe as many as 180. Hillforts are complicated places. They're not simply ancient castles. Instead, they're multi-purpose sites. Hillforts are sites which represent the complicated, fluid nature of society and politics during the British Iron Age. Buckle up, folks. There's a lot in this one. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. The man's shield slaps against the horse's flanks as he trots along a dusty lane. To either side of him were furrowed fields. The farmland stretched from the river behind him to the bright white walls of the fort ahead. Scattered throughout the landscape were roundhouses, smoke curling from their roofs, and here and there, men worked in the fields and women sat outside weaving and cleaning. The horse knows its destination, and it trudges unerringly up the path towards the hill fort. The man whistles happily. There's not much noise about, a few birds tweeting, a couple of people talking and laughing. The air smells of smoke and the early flowers of spring. Soon enough, he's beneath the battlements. They're made of rocks and chalk and shine white in the spring sunshine. People leer over the edge as he rides around them. He can hear the metal workers inside, hammering metal and pumping smoke from their fires. It takes a long time to ride around those white battlements. The grass has been allowed to grow thick and brambly, save for the path that forces you to follow the walls, constantly watched. The man doesn't care much, waving up at the wide eyes of children peering over the walls, excited by any new visitor. Finally, he reaches the entrance. It bulges forward from the walls in two giant horns. The entrance is narrow, and you have to turn left to pass through a second vast gate into the fort. The man waits outside the gate, fully surrounded by huge walls, prickling with vast palisades and bow-wielding guards. The gate creaks open, and the man's horse lolls forward through the gate into the fort itself. Inside, it's buzzing with the noise of activity, chattering, metalworking, cooking, arguing, and screaming as children run around wild, barefoot and mucky from playing. Onwards, up towards the crest of the hill, the man urges his horse. After the battlements, the first buildings are more roundhouses, organised in neat rows around the edges of the walls. Women are outside them, weaving, and the screaming children flit in and out. Those kids are very excited by the horse, who patiently allows them to dart forward to pat it, pausing when they run in front of him. Their mothers look up, exasperated and apologetic. The man grins back at them, then kicks his horse onwards, further up the hill. After the roundhouses lay the occasional industrial areas, small pockets of noise and busyness where men forged iron tools and spearheads. Other places were making pots, some quick, rough, prosaic pieces, others fine, well-painted and decorated. They didn't interest the man. He kept the horse moving up the hill. Ahead of him, there was a knot of people, pulling carts or urging oxen to keep plodding. Those carts were piled high with grain and vegetables, the last of the stores from winter. The man slumped a little in his saddle, his horse slowing down behind the wall of doddering carts, people and oxen. Eventually, though, near the top of the hill, the slow wall comes to a halt. Men and women appear and begin pulling sacks of grain and vegetables down from the carts. They take them away. The grain is poured into pits, the vegetables placed inside dark huts. Amidst all the activity, the man and his horse try and edge forward. They're stopped again and again by people fixated on their tasks, barging past, dragging sacks or shouting at each other. After edging through the thick press of people, the man is free, with only the crest of the hill ahead of him. The hilltop was crowned by four platforms raised high above the ground. They have bright ribbons tied around each post, with fires burning in braziers around every platform. Herbs are regularly thrown into the fire by a man and a woman, both dressed in white robes. Atop the platforms, almost impossible to see, were human cadavers, exposed to the elements. Birds fluttered down and pulled at their innards, squawking at each other. The robed man and woman walk up to the horsemen and bow their heads. The man dismounts and drops to a knee. They greet him with a blessing and he arises and turns to his saddlebags. There was a bag, its bottom stained black, half hidden by a shield. He yanks it hard and it breaks away. The horse snorts its displeasure at the violence. The man takes the shield off the saddle and places the bag on top of the shield. He turns to face the white robes. Taking 3 steps forward, he then kneels down, holding the shield aloft in front of his bowed head. The white-robed woman takes the bag and turns it upside down. From the sack fell 3 heads. All 3 had long hair, their faces dyed blue with woad. The woman took each one and placed it on a low table beneath the platform. The white-robed man raised the horseman from his feet. The woman dips her fingers into the neck of the central head. She smears the gore across the man's forehead. "Well done," she says. The horseman grinned his approval. "God's willing, we won't have any more raids for a little while." Hill forts were the nexus for the development of one version of Celtic society that existed in southern Britain. Of that, we're quite certain. When it comes to saying anything else interesting about hill forts, we're immediately in murky waters. A debate has raged for a long, long time as to what these sites were used for. In my humble opinion, this is because archaeologists have fallen into a trap all too easily tripped by academics of all stripes, the overriding desire to find a single explanation. One archaeologist will look at the vast fortifications and see a clearly military structure. Others will see the number of burials and think they are cemeteries. Still, others will see the burials and vast fortifications and see them as centres of regional control by a small and powerful elite. I think, though, that in more recent academia, it's becoming clear that it is impossible to give hill forts one single cause. Instead, they are deliberately complicated and multi-purpose sites. They were centres of regional control and they were defensive sites. They were also religious sites, and that's because violence and religion were inextricably linked during the British Iron Age. That's the impression I've tried to give with the story you just heard. I've also tried to tell you something about the economy, politics, religion, and warfare of the British Iron Age. We're going to take each of those elements of Iron Age society in turn and see how hill forts played a critical role in each of them. This should, hopefully, give us an insight into the day-to-day life of Celtic Britons. Incidentally, Celtic Britons is a bit of a tautology. Britain just means Celt from southern Britain. I'll use those terms interchangeably. To begin with, let's talk about the economy, the thing which underlies every society. When we left the Bronze Age, the economy was built upon grain farming and supplemented with animal husbandry of cows, pigs, and sheep. Well, not much has changed. In fact, it's almost the exact same. Especially during the early period of Danebury, the economy was indistinguishable from that of Bronze Age Britain. However, the scale has increased, as has the nature of high-end items. It appears that sites like Danebury sat at the heart of an ultra-regional, redistributive economy. What I mean by that is hill forts would be surrounded by lots of farms. Sometimes those farms had accompanying villages, other times everyone lived in the hill forts and went out to the farms every day. It depended on the period and the hill fort. We can see these farm systems today. Britain is dotted with Celtic field systems, a catch-all term for a type of agriculture dominated by small fields interconnected by pathways and small enclosures for animals who were left to graze freely. In this system, there was a preference for pigs and sheep, low-effort animals. Cows were prized, but their numbers limited by the effort they take to keep. This was an agricultural system spanning the early Bronze Age to the early medieval period, so Celtic field system is something of a misnomer. The main thing about these systems is that they are small and local. They are farmed by one family and provide a small surplus. It appears that this food, maybe all of it, perhaps just the surplus, was then carted to the hill fort where it was stored in vast grain pits. These grain pits are very clever. They're so large that you can store literally tons of grain in them. Some of that grain will go off. Bacteria will consume the top 20 or 30 centimetres of grain and water will damage the few centimetres in contact with the sides of the pit. However, this is maybe only 2 or 3% of the grain. The rest is kept perfectly, inaccessible to mice or rats and protected from the rain and air. We'll be coming back to the grain pits when we come to the bodies. The economy of the early and middle Iron Ages was one of local production mixed with highly centralized storage and redistribution. That storage was to ensure communal harmony and to protect the food from the many raids, which we'll discuss soon. That's a neat picture, but even in this first point, we hit a critical debate about Iron Age society, something unavoidable. What was the nature of control during the Iron Age? The economic role of hill forts is that of a hyper-safe grain storage pit, from which food was then redistributed to the community. However, we don't know whether this was a relative of the egalitarian community working together to ensure everyone was fed and that food was protected, or whether hill forts were elite centres who controlled the food supply and used that control to sit atop an economy based around the giving of gifts and services. Unfortunately, the burials don't help us much here. There is little evidence of one specific social class being buried. There are no rich grave goods. In fact, the objects we do have are very prosaic. The nicest things are the pots, of which we have a number of beautifully decorated, finely made pieces. Pots, though. That's it. No spectacular burials, no brooches or gorgeous jewellery, no weaponry. I think I've got an explanation, though. You see, on the surface, it appears obvious that there must be a hierarchy in the Iron Age. Hill forts are massive sites with clear evidence of centralization, and the Greeks and Romans talk about Celtic kings. I'm afraid to say, though, that in this period, history, the written word, has started to infect our record. It has forced us to assume that large sites must be evidence of kings. Forgive me whilst I indulge in some light-hearted ribaldry against my second favourite subject, history, on behalf of my first, archaeology. There's a phrase that archaeologists are taught to despise during their freshman year. Archaeology is the handmaiden of history. It captures an old-fashioned perspective that archaeology exists to paint in the bits of the past not covered by history. Unfortunately, many historians still sometimes think like that, which causes many ale-filled arguments in pubs up and down the country. This view thinks it's just great when archaeology shows us about the day-to-day lives of people living during a period when history only talks about the elites. Archaeology is also marvellous when it proves history, like finding Richard III under a car park. However, beyond that, it doesn't have the same grandeur, the same importance, the same intellectual prominence that belongs to history. Well, my friends, let me tell you, that is nonsense. In thinking like that, historians are forgetting the very first thing they're taught. History is flawed. It's full of biases. That's not to say archaeology is better mind. It's just that its weaknesses are often history's strengths and vice versa. For example, archaeology is excellent at giving you a lot of detail about a lot of anonymous people. We learn what they ate, where they lived, and how they died. History often gives us a whole load of details about a small number of specific named people who are usually very rich and very important. They tell us about their religious ceremonies, their struggles, their joys, and their opinions, but not what life was like for the majority. Their accounts also come with a whole heap of ulterior motives. And that is why, when it comes to Iron Age Britons, history has ruined the archaeological record. The people who give us our historical understanding of Britain at this time aren't really talking about Britain. Our histories are terrified, half-legendary accounts of the Celtic sacking of Rome in 390 BCE, or dismissive Greek descriptions of their northern neighbours from a similar time, or Julius Caesar writing, well, bragging, hundreds of years after our period. These people tell us that Celts had kings, so when archaeologists go and dig, their results are interpreted in light of that historical understanding, which is often wrong, racist, and frankly, irrelevant, both in terms of time and geography. It's a bold claim to apply the same social structure to people who lived either hundreds of miles away, hundreds of years apart, or both at the same time. Furthermore, our Greco-Roman authors lived in extremely chauvinistic, highly hierarchical societies. They didn't try and write empathetic history. They wrote what they saw, as they saw it. And to them, the Celts had a rudimentary, undeveloped social structure with violent kings who drank and fought their way to the top. It's the same barbarizing exotification that we're so critical of during the colonial periods of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. We must be equally wary of these ancient records, even when they're written by geniuses like Aristotle and Herodotus. This early, patchy, and problematic historical record introduces a whole load of bias into our interpretation of the archaeological record, making it a constant fight to look at the data on its own merits. Indeed, over the next couple of episodes, I'm going to be bringing in the historical record whenever I can to try and add some flesh or colour onto the bones. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know if I've been 100% able to avoid the biases introduced by these texts. But let's do our best to ditch the picture of the mustachioed man atop a shield. He might have existed, but not in our period and not at Danebury. Instead, here's how I think we can see the development of hierarchy during the Iron Age. In the Late Bronze Age, society was fragmentary. Whilst impressive metalworking did continue, it fell very much into two camps, military hardware and religious objects. This was a time of deep religious belief and the constant presence or threat of violence. These themes continued into the Iron Age and Celtic culture we're discussing today, and we'll come to those themes soon enough. However, the material culture and social organisation changed during the period in which Danebury was active. People started banding together, building sanctuaries they could flee to and use to store their grain. They worked together. They created a pragmatic material culture built on warm, richly decorated woolen cloth, finely decorated pottery, and saved their metalworking for practical tools and weapons. Men and women had separate roles. The men were in charge of the outside world. They dealt in violence, industry, and farming. The women were in charge of the domestic world, weaving, pot making, child rearing. When decisions had to be made about the community as a whole, the men debated, with the greatest respect going to the greatest warriors. It's from these great warriors that hierarchy begins to form at the very end of Danebury's existence. Men who could command large numbers due to their prowess and charisma were able to bring greater and greater wealth both to their communities and to themselves. Other men, less powerful, took on roles as priests, and they combined the equal importance of the natural world which gave life and the violent world which brought death into a brutal, naturalistic religion which we call Druidism. It is this world which the men like Julius Caesar and Tacitus described. It's from this warrior culture that we get men like Vercingetorix, the last great warlord of the Gauls or continental Celts. This broad outline was followed by the myriad of regional groups we bundled together into the Celtic umbrella, but at different speeds and with a constant multitude of regional variations. In the next two episodes, we'll explore the later part of this broad narrative in more detail. But for now, let's talk about the intervening period, the early and middle Iron Ages. This was a period of competitive communalism. Communities were self-sufficient and focused around a central hill fort in a small regional area. Within those regions, decisions were made by the most respected warriors of the group, and that's because competition in this period meant raiding, small-scale violence focused on ritual retribution, theft, and naked power politics. This violence was blessed and mediated by a burgeoning priest class, supported by the community's surplus. This violently religious world is a complicated one. Let's pause for a moment. Take a breath. We'll be back soon. I'm sorry to announce we're not going to talk about Druids today. They're so important, so complicated, that we're going to give them their very own episode. I also think that whilst it's probably fair to call these priests druids, they're not yet the druids we think of. Instead, these are proto-druids, and what we are interested in today is what we can learn about Iron Age religion from the burials at Danebury. There are four key tenets of Iron Age belief that can be observed at Danebury. 1. The human body is a source of fertility and fertility as security. 2. The fundamental unity of humanity and nature. 3. The importance of intelligence and personality. And 4. Religion is something adaptable to a region's needs. Just before we get to explaining how those tenets are referenced in the burials, let's explain the nature of the burials and bodies. Danebury isn't a cemetery, nor is it a grave. It's a settlement, a fort in which burials were made. Actually, burial is a misleading term. The only people who were buried in specifically dug graves were the few bodies of neonatal infants. That means the bodies of children who died before they were born. It appears these tragedies were treated with tenderness and given simple rites different from those of adults. These special rites maybe didn't have any spiritual power, but did allow the parents to grieve. The rest of the burials are in grain pits. That's right, grain pits. Don't worry, the pits were disused. It seems, though, that very few people were buried, and when they were buried in pits that had been previously used for grain. 10% of the pits dug at Danebury contain some sort of burial. That's 182 instances of deposition from at least 90 distinct individuals. The burials in those grain pits were pretty plain. No grave goods worth mentioning. It is almost always the case that one person is buried in each grain pit. However, the actual bodies that were placed in the pits were interesting. Sometimes their bodies were fully articulated, full skeletons buried soon after death. The vast majority of burials, though, are single body parts. Often these are arms and legs, but usually they're skulls. There's evidence these body parts had decayed before they were placed in the pits. The bones beneath the tendons and muscle connections are weathered, suggesting they've been exposed to wear. On a rare occasion, though, that's not the case, and the bodies have been put into the pits immediately after death. We spoke earlier that in the Iron Age, the external wild world was the realm of men. Well, that's mirrored in our burials here. The majority of burials at Danebury are males. This suggests one of the triggers for burial, rather than, say, excarnation, is a death associated with that external world. That's supported by the violent injuries to many of the skeletons. 7.9% of the bones found, potentially 14 people, were found to have suffered violent deaths. Of particular note are a number of skulls with dry injuries, injuries made after death, suggesting the heads have been removed with quite a lot of brutality. Here's the thing, finding definite evidence of violence in the archaeological record is quite rare. Most people who die violent deaths don't suffer any bone damage. Let me give you an example. Imagine Boromir from Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring, Sean Bean, a fellow Yorkshireman. Well, typically, because it's Sean Bean, in The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, he dies. He was shot with 3 arrows. Now imagine we were going to dig up Boromir's body. Unless those arrowheads broke a rib, we wouldn't know that he died violently. His flesh would rot away, the arrows would be removed, and in the archaeological record of Middle-earth, his body would provide no clues. Oh, and since he was laid to rest on a river, we'd never find his body, which is probably what was happening during the Late Bronze Age. All that to say, while 7.9% might not sound like a big number, it's not the size of the number that counts. What is important here is that there is definite, undeniable evidence of violence, including post-mortem injuries, specifically decapitation. It's probable that many of the other people represented at Danebury also died violent deaths, but the cause of their death isn't physically there on their skeletons. So here's what we have. At least 90, maybe up to 180 individuals, all without any significant grave goods. These people were not buried all at once, but instead burials were a rare but special occurrence throughout the 400 to 500 years of Danebury's use during the Iron Age. The children who died before coming to term were buried in graves. Everyone else was buried in grave pits. Those who were buried were usually, but not always, male. Often it was simply a skull or limb placed in the pits. But occasionally, a full human was placed at the bottom of a disused grain pit. On some of those individual body parts, there is evidence of excarnation, and on many of the bodies, we see the telltale marks of violent death or brutal post-mortem decapitation. That's a lot of information, and unsurprisingly, that tells us a lot about religion and belief in Southwest Britain 2,600 to 2,100 years ago. The first is that this is evidence of a singular culture slowly evolving over time. We can speak about the religion of such a long period as a consistent whole because their burial practices remain consistent over that long period. So, what do we learn? I think what these burials are telling us is that this religion was one which was innately tied to the natural cycles of the earth. It was a belief system that saw humans as powerful agents in the world. People could affect the world. The rites which surrounded this religion were ones which sought to use the powerful human agency to reconnect humanity with the natural world in return for security and fertility. This was a religion which saw the natural world as the source of humanity's strength and saw the role of faith as one which used that human vigour to reconnect humanity to a capricious natural world. There are, as I said, 4 tenets which can be observed which help us to create that picture. To remind you, those are 1, the human body is a source of fertility and fertility as security. 2, the fundamental unity of humanity and nature. 3, the vitality and agency of people and personality. And four, the adaptability of religion to a region's needs. I think it's clear why I think the human body was seen as a source of fertility. Anyone more than a baby was buried in a grain pit. This ties the human body closely with probably the single most important feature type in Danebury. Grain pits might not be exciting to you and me, but they were one of the primary purposes of hill forts like Danebury. Those hill forts provided a dry, defensible place to store food. In a world where, for a third of the year, nothing is growing, having food safe and set aside was quite literally the difference between life and death. Burying people in disused grain pits was an act of thanks and of ritual killing. It's a thankful act because you were giving back to the earth a source of nutrients. By this time, people would have known that animal and human excrement made fields richer. They would have noticed by now the macabre reality that crops growing on the site of recent battles would grow taller and richer. By giving back a human body, they are asking the earth to keep their crops rich and nutritious. Actually, now we come to it, it's probable that every human in and around Danebury was given back to the world. In the story, we spoke about platforms at the top of Danebury Hill, on which human bodies were left, exposed, to be removed by beasts and wind and rain. They were excarnated. Danebury is the only hill in its area, and the excarnation structures were raised platforms at the tallest point of Danebury. Atop these, every human, save for the small minority buried in grain pits, were given over to the natural world to be taken away by Mother Nature at will. I also think it's possible to see the placing of dead people into disused grain pits as an act of ritual killing, again, to encourage greater and richer food sources. We can't forget that this was an agricultural world. Almost everyone, 95% of people at least, were full-time farmers. It's likely that many of their religious acts were ritualized aspects of agricultural life. One of the most important things in agriculture is ensuring the health of your fields and animals. Weeds are pulled out, fields are ploughed, and the weak and sick animals are slaughtered. Keeping things healthy entails an element of culling. I think that's what's happening at these grain pits. Once they were used up and their sides infected with gone-off grain, they were killed, culled, removed from service, so that the other grain pits that were in use would remain richer and healthier and more fertile. So, the burials in grain pits are a thank you for your service before those pits were closed forever. That, to me, at least speaks to a world in which the burials, the religion, and by inference the society was one that was, understandably, obsessed by fertility, because a fertile world was a safe world. Fat men don't raid, fed children don't starve, and starving people don't love. Everything good in the world comes from a secure food source. So society could stay safe, stay fertile. Humans were given back to the world. Usually that meant excarnation, but sometimes it meant thanking the earth itself for keeping their food safe, and then ritually killing the unnecessary storage pits so that the other pits would be stronger and safer too. All of this suggests a strong connection, a unity between humanity and the natural world. In an agrarian society, it would have been obvious that humans were just part of the world. All social, agricultural, and personal cycles would have been tied to the rhythms of nature. For example, humans slept when it was dark and worked when it was light, just like any other animal. There has, in many cultures, been a link between the 28-day cycles of the moon and the monthly menstrual cycles of women. Also, the times of raiding, when death came to society, would have been when all the food had been collected in late summer, when the world was about to start dying again. Humans are natural beings. Whereas in Bronze Age society, for example at Stonehenge, there is a clear effort to connect humans to the celestial realm, which speaks to at least some concept of an eternal part of humans which lives beyond the earthly realm. That's not present in the Iron Age. Instead, from the excarnations and burials, we get a sense that this was a religion and society which saw people as an integral part of the natural world. These were burial practices designed not to just give back to the world, but to reconnect humanity with the natural world. In a way, it's a terrestrial version of Buddhist or Hindu nirvana. Rather than reaching enlightenment and joining the spirit in the sky, humans die and join the natural world. You could infer from this tenet of Iron Age faith that there was probably a degree of animism to the faith. Animism is the catch-all term for the myriad belief systems which see every element of the natural world as somehow sacred. For a simple and catchy introduction to what animism is essentially about, listen to The Colours of the Wind from Disney's Pocahontas. As she sings whilst paddling, I know every rock and tree and creature has a life, has a spirit, has a name. Incidentally, this speaks to what we do know of druidic beliefs. Theirs was a world in which every part of the world was tied to a different god, a different spirit, especially the trees. However, just because humans are a part of nature doesn't mean the Iron Age folk saw us as flotsam on the sea of life. No, humans had agency. They could act, and they could and did change the world. Anyone who has read Asterix and Obelix, or Caesar's Gallic Wars, or played as the Gauls on Rome Total War, will recognise the classic image of a glorious Celtic warrior, a man who would fight naked, painted in woad, mano a mano. The image of the Celts we get from the written sources is one in which the point of the war wasn't just victory, but unending glory. One man could become a hero. As we discussed earlier, I'm not necessarily sold on this. However, the archaeological evidence suggests that the human, the person, was a vital force capable of changing the world. That's because at Danebury, there's an overrepresentation of skulls in the burials. Yes, there's arms and legs, but there's a lot of skulls, and sometimes it's clear that those heads were brutally chopped off after death. The skull, in both world anthropology and in the literature we have about many Iron Age societies in Europe, suggests that skulls were seen as the source of life and personality. If you own someone's skull, you own their life force. You control or absorb what makes them human. I'm going to throw it out there. I buy the idea that a key part of Celtic politics and warfare was the religious and ritualistic practice of headhunting. My critical piece of evidence is that overrepresentation of skulls in the grain pits and the post-mortem decapitation. If you want to keep the head of a loved one for whatever reason, you're gentle. You don't mistreat the body of someone you care about. Even if there's no religion not to, would any normal sane person butcher their friend or family? No. And when there is a religious reason, for example at Cladhallan, humans who are loved are cared for, they're treated well. At Cladhallan they were even replaced when they broke. But butchering your enemies, that makes sense, right? You've already killed them, and we see throughout history that even when there are no religious or ritual need to do so, during battle humans go a little loopy and can inflict grievous injury, even after the person has died. As I suggested in the story which opened this discussion, skulls were captured during battle and brought back to Danebury. There they were buried, forever capturing the life force of their enemies, and therefore enriching their land, power and status. This is also a good time to highlight the thin, blurry line in Iron Age society between religion and politics. Quite often those two went hand in hand. Finally, the last tenet of the Iron Age religion isn't a complicated one, but it is important to note. Religion in the Iron Age wasn't monolithic. Danebury has far more burials than your average Iron Age site, even when we take into consideration its 400 to 500 years of occupation. At Danebury, some people were buried. That was a critical part of their culture and religion. It wouldn't have necessarily held true for their neighbours. Instead, whilst the three tenets I've outlined above were probably universal throughout Iron Age society in Britain, the ritual form those religious imperatives took could vary massively. Some people would have been cremated, their ashes scattered onto the fields. Others may have been buried in rivers and lakes. Some people would have collected far more skulls. Others buried humans near important agricultural places like entrances to fields. Iron Age religion, politics, culture and society was a variable and varied thing. However, at the heart of it, there were a few core cultural imperatives which tied all these differences together into a loose but observable confederation. These were the close relationship between human and nature, and the importance of the vitality of individual people. Another cultural imperative visible in the archaeological record, especially at Danebury, one which ties in with our documentary evidence of Celtic cultures throughout Europe, was the importance of warfare and violence to their society. This isn't the industrialized brutality that comes with the Greeks and Romans. It's small-scale, glorious, ritualized raiding. Like cannibalism, human sacrifice, or most things exciting, archaeologists are understandably nervous about being definite when it comes to warfare. It's hard to see and tough to evidence. Archaeologists are, after all, scientists, and they're cautious about making statements they can't back up. However, I think when the pretty strong archaeological evidence matches up with multiple historic documents, We have to accept that European Iron Age society, Celtic culture, was one where violence was a part of life, perhaps even a celebrated part of life. Before you get excited, this wasn't warfare on the scale of Caesar's Gallic Wars. Iron Age society in Britain was defined by small, multiple, interlinked regions. Many Iron Age societies in Europe only put aside their differences and unified into something state-like in the face of a rare outside force stronger than themselves. There wasn't the population or the centralised control necessary to create or command large armies. Nor is there evidence of big battles. No hill forts have any evidence of destruction until the Romans arrive. Indeed, at Danebury, the only evidence of warfare is from the skeletons which we've already discussed. Instead, what I think is going on is that there is this whole heap of raiding, and I think those raids were prompted by three particular forces. The first is plain and simple theft. Fundamentally, I think this is why hill forts exist, a safe place to store your grain against the people who would try and steal it. This was a world in which the regions were small and the source of food limited. It's an economic setup that's at risk of famine, like all pre-industrial agricultural communities. When one region was famine-struck, it's understandable that they tried to ease their desperation by taking the food of their rivals. It might also be that raids were opportunistic. A powerful neighbour sensed weakness, an opportunity to grapple up another spoke of the ever-rolling wheel of power. They attacked, hit their foes whilst they were weak and gained a little more wealth, a little more security, a little more certainty for their young children, a chance to develop a stronger population. These things matter to a small agricultural community. This reason for raiding also brings a sense of justice to some of the burials in the pits, especially those with decapitated heads. They were thrown into the pits that stored the very grain they were coming to steal. That's the second reason for violence. A raid would be launched against the perpetrators of a successful raid to punish them for their thievery. Finally, all violence during this time period had a religious aspect. This is something we see in many cultures. The Anglo-Saxons for many years would usually fight on a preset field with hazel sticks defining the edges of the battlefield. If you left the hazel rods, you left the battle. The Aztecs went to war, yes, for conquering, but also to capture victims for religious sacrifice. Murder is such an extreme act, many cultures have needed to add a whole lot of ritualization to make it palatable. We do this today. What is nationalism or patriotism other than a secular religion with your nation as your god? When encouraged to fight for king and country, that's not really any different to being encouraged to fight for God, whatever the name may be. That's why Iron Age cultures developed a cult of headhunting. It allowed them to take the murder on the battlefields into the sacred places and sanctify their brutality. They're similar to the ancient Jewish sacrifices, which were taken deep into the temple and given over to God. That process of taking something gory into somewhere clean has a sanitizing, cleansing effect. This also speaks to what we understand from the histories of the role of druids. They're not just cool woodland priests. Instead, they're people who glue together a disparate society. What have we understood about society so far? It was competitive, hyper-regional. It was fragile and it was fractious. That doesn't sound like a recipe for harmony now, does it? To keep any harmony, or, you know, to keep the lid on any tensions, required a special class. This is what their priest class, these proto-druids, did. They were teachers, priests, lawyers, and historians. Some have even called them philosophers. However, I think what the history and archaeology show isn't some enlightened investment in an intelligentsia or learning class to champion industrial development. Instead, these people existed and used their knowledge to create an overarching cultural identity through which differences could be mitigated. They learned history so they could explain why things were the way they were. They were lawyers so they could settle disputes and priests to imbibe them with an authority that sat outside political authority. As I said, we'll talk more about Druidic religion in our last episode of this season. But a key concept for today is that Celtic religion or politics wasn't about exerting control or changing the world. It was more accepting, pliant in the face of the natural world. There was a state of things and it was about maintaining that balance. The Druids or proto-Druids didn't stop warfare or headhunting. Instead, they encouraged a consistent small-scale violence. They were pragmatic. They recognised that a degree of violence acted as a vent for tensions, a route towards glory for young men, and, I'm sure, a source of division which intelligent, magical men who sat outside the political world could exploit. The story of the horsemen which opened up this discussion took us from a river up to the centre of a hill fort. It touched on the economic, political, religious and violent nature of Iron Age society. Let's break it down and summarise what we have learned. We began with a man riding his horse through fields, a river behind him, a hill fort ahead of him. This speaks to the economic and geographical reality of early and middle Iron Age society. Hillforts sat at the centre of small communities. To be successful, they had to control enough farmland to support their population, but also enough resources. The land in between a hillfort and natural barriers like rivers and hills was the total extent from which those communities could peacefully extract resources. The consequences of this are seen in the man who rides his horse. His shield was slapping against his horse's flank. This reminds us that warfare was small scale and relied on mobile, talented warriors who could steal from or visit revenge for theft upon neighbouring groups. Raiding was a vital part of the economic setup of these small scale societies. The hill fort itself is a place owned by the community. Men act as either farmers, industrialists, or warriors. No group could exist without the other, by the way. Warriors needed food and weapons, farmers needed tools and protection. It was a virtuous triangle, supported by domestic cottage industry run by the women of the society. Danebury didn't act as a centre of political control by an elite. Instead, in its early stages, it was simply a safe refuge. Over its history, it became more and more so the centre of a community where most people lived. As it became more important, the walls were made larger, more impressive and more defensible. This reflected a larger, more complex society, but also a greater sense of cultural and regional identity, which we'll see in more detail in our next episode. Whether it was occupied by a whole community or only a few, Danebury's eternal purpose was to protect the all-important grain supply. In the same way, no matter how large the place got, Danebury was never a site of centralised control by an elite. Instead, at the heart of this environment was a death-obsessed religion. At the top of Danebury's Hill was a place for excarnation, a way for humans to return to the natural world. This is the way most people were buried. On a rare occasion, humans were buried in a disused grain pit. Maybe this was a sacrifice in thanks for a successful raid, or as a way to plead with the natural world, the gods, for more food or greater security. It is there, at the centre of the hill fort, this safe, intimidating place, that our horseman returns with the successes of his raid, and presents them to the priest class, who approve all major decisions. This is the world of Danebury that I imagine, a fractious and fragmentary world. It's a precarious time, and that uncertainty gave birth to a fascinating religious belief and social structure. Whilst this is a fair summation of the whole of British Iron Age society, the multitude of societies that existed meant that no one region was identical. Next week, we'll explore the Iron Age of Yorkshire. It is, of course, home to one of the coolest of Iron Age traditions, chariot burials. I hope you can join me, and if you have been joining me quite a bit recently, maybe like us on Facebook, follow on Instagram, or even become a patron on patreon.com. All those details can be found at oldbones.co.uk. Stay safe, my friends. I'll see you soon. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones. Thank you.